Suddenly the small germ of an idea began to grow into the basis for a book. Originally, Twain's reverence for Lamort d'Arthur even overwhelmed his usually irrepressible satiric streak, for he said he planned to leave unsmirched and belittled the great and beautiful characters drawn by the master hand of Malory. It was to be a labor of love and leisure. "I expect to write 3 chapters a year for 30 years. Then the book will be done. I'm writing it for posterity only, my posterity, my great-grandchildren. It is to be my holiday amusement for 6 days every summer the rest of my life. Of course, I do not expect to publish it, nor indeed any other book." But suddenly, the slow pace of his writing picked up, and the approach seems to have changed somehow. Matthew Arnold, who Twain considered England's most obnoxious critic, had been lambasting American life as vulgar and uncultured relentlessly. Perhaps this was the reason Connecticut Yankee became, as Twain later wrote in his autobiography, "an attempt to imagine, and after a fashion set forth, the hard conditions of life for the laboring and defenseless poor in bygone times in England, and incidentally contrast these conditions with those under which the civil and ecclesiastical pets of privilege and high fortune lived in those times. I think I was purposing to contrast that English life with the life of modern Christendom and modern civilization, to the advantage of the latter, of course." That last little afterthought is yet another joke, for the 19th century is made fun of just as ruthlessly as the 6th. Even though Franklin D. Roosevelt lifted the term New Deal from Connecticut Yankee, it is also a satire and a critique of American optimism, presenting ultimately the view that material progress may very well bring chaos and destruction. And now, a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Preface. The ungentle laws and customs touched upon in this tale are historical, and the episodes which are used to illustrate them are also historical. It's not pretended that these laws and customs existed in England in the 6th century. No, it's only pretended that, inasmuch as they existed in the English and other civilizations of far later times, it's safe to consider that it's no libel upon the 6th century to suppose them to have been in practice in that day also. One's quite justified in inferring that wherever one of these laws or customs was lacking in that remote time, its place was competently filled by a worse one. The question as to whether there's such a thing as divine right of kings isn't settled in this book. It was found too difficult. That the executive head of a nation should be a person of lofty character and extraordinary ability was manifest and indisputable. That none but the deity could select that head unerringly was also manifest and indisputable. That the deity ought to make that selection, then, was likewise manifest and indisputable. Consequently, that he does make it, as claimed, was an unavoidable deduction. I mean, until the author of this book encountered the Pompadour and Lady Castlemaine and some other executive heads of that kind. These were found so difficult to work into the scheme that it was judged better to take the other tack in this book, which must be issued this fall, and then go into training and settle the question in another book. It is, of course, a thing which ought to be settled, and I'm not going to have anything particular to do next winter anyway. Mark Twain, Hartford, July 21st, 1889. A word of explanation. It was in Warwick Castle that I came across the curious stranger whom I'm going to talk about. He attracted me by 3 things. His candid simplicity, his marvelous familiarity with ancient armor, and the restfulness of his company, for he did all the talking. We fell together, as modest people will, in the tail of a herd that was being shown through, and he at once began to say things that interested me. As he talked along, softly